The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. And so after 129 days, 17 hours and 31 minutes, Croatia finally get tired. Two glorious goals from the Pulis Beck songbook mean England are through to the semi-finals of the Nations League for the first time in their history. We've all booked our tickets to go to Croydon Box Park for another summer where we can forget the world is falling apart and cover ourselves in watery lager. Elsewhere, it's mid-table mediocrity for Wales, one place above the rock-bottom Republic of Ireland. No points for Northern Ireland, but hope for Scotland, who see off Albania to set up a winner-takes-all contest with Israel. We'll round up the Football League and try and work out if Gordon Taylor needs money even less than Richard Scudamore. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Welcome back, Paul Watson.
Thank you.
Nice to see you.
Yeah, basking in the glory, the Nations League glory, I suppose.
Well, it sounds like you're being cynical.
No, far from it, far from it. I couldn't sleep last night.
Okay, excellent. Here's a message from Evan G. As a listener on the west coast of the United States, I for one appreciate the appalling working conditions that Max has forced upon the panel this week, as in last week. I can listen to the pod during my early morning commute. The panel's misery is my gain. Barry, we are back to a normal record time. Could you apologise to Evan G?
Why do I need to apologise?
Because now he can't listen on his morning commute on the west coast of the United States because you all threaten strike action unless we change the recording time back to 10:30 in the morning.
I didn't threaten strike action. You're presuming Evan G is a he Evan. It could be a she Evan.
It could be.
I prefer recording at 10:30. I mean, everything we'd done last Thursday was completely out of date by the time the podcast went live because we'd recorded so early. Things move on.
They could still move on this morning.
Well, they could. We'll see.
John says, is Lars Sivertsen the new Arsene Wenger? Not knowing when to step away from the limelight with his constant appearing every week on the pod. How do you plead, Lars?
It's a completely fair question to ask. The only good news I have for you is that I sound like a completely different person today. I've got Nations League fever, I think.
Are you on your Lars legs?
Oh, God. No, but it's that time of the year where London, and in particular public transport in London, turns into just a number of like petri dishes full of bacteria and foulness, and avoiding illness in the city is almost impossible. So, you know.
Well, I quite like it.
Plodding through injury, as it were.
A touch of the frost drops you've got with this.
Yep.
He doesn't sound well. I've got to say, we should enjoy him while we've got him.
Mm.
That's also good news to listeners who are tired of me. You know, I might die. It might be the end.
At least wait till part three.
Lowered the tone a bit, do you think?
England 2, Croatia 1. This from Dale Johnson on ESPN. England's 2-1 victory over Croatia. The first time ever in 601 competitive internationals that they've won a game in 90 minutes when trailing with 15 minutes left. Paul, you're the only other Englishman here. I am, obviously, look at Barry's face. I'm really enthused by everything that Gareth Southgate has done with this England team, and I'm just really happy about it.
Yeah, no, me too. And I think there's two separate issues here for me. The England team, great. Very strange watching an England team play with some heart, actually potentially some good players for the future coming through. That's a really strange emotion, sort of a feeling of pride. The Nations League as a whole, I feel like we missed a training course on this. The tournament is just completely baffling. It's baffling for me in that ultimately, what are we going to get out of this?
It's the possibility to win a trophy.
A trophy, yeah. But I mean, it's a trophy that no one's really going to care about. It's the Anglo-Italian Cup of international football.
You could argue people might have said that about the first couple of World Cups, you know, but it was invitation only. A lot of teams didn't bother entering it.
A lot of teams didn't make it. You know, you had to go by boat. Teams were lost.
the English are still out there in some ghost ship.
Yeah, I don't agree with you at all, Paul. I think I was, like everyone, confused about it at the start, didn't take it very seriously in the first game with Spain, realised that these games are so much better than friendlies. And and not just the England games, but, you know, there've been some really, really good football matches throughout the whole thing and in the different divisions as well. So I
love the fact that they're meaningful football, and I actually really like it for the small teams like Group D, the fact that you finally, teams like Gibraltar getting wins. I do really like that. I like the fact the games mean more, you don't get these endless substitutions. Don't get me wrong, the friendlies are awful. We've got rid of them. What gets me is that actually, ultimately, what lies at the end of this is pretty futile. It's a tournament that nobody really knows what it's worth, and possibly a slightly greater chance of qualifying for a tournament that England would really struggle not to qualify for anyway. So it just seems like a really strange mixture. And I think there's a lot of good there, but also ultimately I can't help but feel this is, I guess, pointless.
I mean, ultimately, Paul,
most things
everything
are.
Is
you're going to do the
right?
all existence thing, but more pointless than, say, winning the World Cup or a tournament that
sure,
you know,
sure,
but marginally less pointless than friendlies, though, I guess, is the point.
I suppose,
and that's a step in the right
direction. I mean, if you look at the match yesterday, both teams were going at it hammer and tongs. It was really entertaining. England were delighted to win, and Croatia were pretty devastated. Their players were scattered around the Wembley turf. It was like a battle scene in Game of Thrones. You know, they were just upset to have lost and exhausted with the effort they've put in. You'd never get that at a friendly. They just, you know, whatever, troop off and go back to the club. So and also, the extra competitiveness gives the fans something to get their teeth into. They really enjoyed the game yesterday, and there was probably a lot more people at Wembley than there would have been if it wasn't a competitive game. Just because it's not as competitive as, say, a World Cup quarterfinal or a European Championship finals game, you know, I don't think it's any the poorer for that. It's certainly better than friendlies, which are a monumental waste of everybody's time.
And some excellent performances, Lars, throughout that England team.
And I think part of the significance of England's Nations League campaign is that you've beaten Croatia now, you've also beaten Spain. You know, as much as there was a justifiable euphoria in this country during the summer, it was still a World Cup in which England kind of didn't beat anyone really good and kind of got knocked out the second they did meet someone really good and then lost to someone good again in the bronze final, whatever you want to call it. So the fact that they've gone and beaten Spain and Croatia in games that count, I think, is quite significant. And I think it's remarkable. We can joke about how the goals were from the Tony Pulis, John Beck playbook, and they kind of were. But just watching this team play, we are now seeing, I think, to a large extent, what we were frustrated by for so long that we didn't see, which is namely English players who play for their national team in a manner that's, you know, recognizable from how they play for their club teams. If you go back to, it's one of my favorite examples is the Iceland game, not just because it was really funny, but also because you saw so many examples of professionals who, whatever you think of them, whether they're overrated or pampered or whatever, they're usually good professional footballers who suddenly couldn't do the basics, like Rooney couldn't trap a ball and Kane couldn't send a simple 5-yard pass. And I think that game was just a study in sports psychology and of a team just having a complete mental breakdown for numerous reasons. And whatever you think of Gareth Southgate's England, they don't look like a team who'll ever have that kind of breakdown. He's managed to create an atmosphere in which players can play the football they're capable of playing.
And evolving from the World Cup, where we had three at the back, to now play a four and not play two holding midfields. I mean, I don't know how you define Delf, but he's certainly got more.
I don't think Delf knows how you define Delf
no,
either.
But it was an interesting selection. I was surprised that he was in, and I would have maybe gone for Winks. But actually, I thought he was very impressive in the fact that he can break up play like Dyer and Henderson, but he can also sort of take the ball past players and pass the ball well as well.
Well, there was that wonderful long defence-splitting pass through
to right
Raheem
well,
Sterling.
Yeah.
It was fantastic. I would have thought you'd describe, without wanting to get bogged down semantics or anything, I thought it was sort of a double defensive midfield, but Delph's sort of rehabilitation as a player, I suppose, has been hugely impressive. And while I think I was a bit of a surprise to see him in the side, I thought he played really well.
And the back four as well, there's just depth everywhere, Paul. You know, I'm sure I'm getting carried away, but I think
it's not like you.
No, Gomez looks like a great player, doesn't he?
It's one of the best England teams I can remember seeing. Now that doesn't make it particularly a brilliant England team, but I think you've got to be pretty excited by what Southgate's creating. If anything, in terms of mentality as well as in terms of the way the team plays. But I do think it's a very different art, what we're seeing here, to the art of winning a competition. So, you know, that's the intangible here. How does a team perform when they're sent into this World Cup or Euro format where you've got, you know, a limited number of games coming thick and fast at you? Psychologically, also physically, how do we cope with it? I think England teams have always done really poorly because that's when the press attention gets negative, it gets quite toxic. And we're not seeing that for the Europa League, Nations League. And whether that's because of it being, because of this being a team that's actually won the hearts of the nation, or whether that's because basically people aren't getting fired up by it. It is such a different thing to take a team out and try and win.
You're right,
a tournament.
But the depth, when you say, well, if somebody is tired or can't play two and three, you know, if you don't play Walker, you can play Alexander Arnold, who played very well against the USA, or Trippier. If you don't play Chilwell, you can play Rose or Shaw. There are players that can come into centre back in midfield. It's hard to know the best three at all. I mean, I find that really difficult to know who you
for go sure.
To.
But what would excite me the most, if I were a massive England fan, is just the word team. I think there have been more impressive names in England squad in the latter year. We've had more impressive collections of big names, but I don't remember seeing an England setup that looked as much as a team, as a coherent unit, as 11 players who knew what they were all meant to be doing and worked well together. That's something we saw in the summer, and it's part of why it was so much fun watching them, even though all the goals came from set pieces and whatever. It looks so much more like a coherent and functional team than England has for so long, and that's, I think, for me, the biggest takeaway, really, and what I would be the most excited about.
And actually, as Paul mentioned, something we're not very good at is, from that statistic, is winning games when we go behind, especially, Barry, against Croatia, who are street, you know, what's that word, streetwise? They say streetwise, aren't they? They know how to hold a lead. This game looked exactly like the semi-final in a way that we would have all the play, we'd have all these chances, we'd play good football, and then they would just go and beat us.
Yeah, well, their goal came completely against the run of play, and I suppose an England team of old would have just resigned themselves to their fate and not fought back particularly hard. But England, you know, were, even though they came from behind, they were more than deserving winners because they had been vastly superior to Croatia up to that. I mean, if you were to sort of pick a negative from yesterday's performance, it kind of showed up what the mistake was at the World Cup, but at least it shows they've learned from their mistake. I still think England should have and could have beaten Croatia in that semi-final. I think it was a massive opportunity lost rather than something to be celebrated. And it's not an opinion that'll change, even though I know it's not one you share with me. But yeah, there are lots of reasons to be cheerful yesterday. England are kind of everything. I look at the Republic of Ireland, England are everything they're not. You know, they're young, they have a coherent plan, they're enthusiastic, and then I just look at the absolute shambles that is the Republic of Ireland football team at the moment, and I'm quite envious.
It's also, there was one moment I thought was significant, which is in previous years, and it's touching slightly upon something I've said already, but Gary Neville wrote in a column once that when things started to go wrong, in their own headspaces, they were immediately thinking, oh God, what's the press going to write about us tomorrow? And they were not focused on fixing the problem. In adversity, the first thought wasn't, how do we fix this? It was, oh God, it's going wrong, right? And I thought it was really interesting. After the Lingard goal went in, there was this shot on TV, and you could clearly see that Harry Kane was telling everyone to settle down, like, it'll be fine. Like, it was in the 78th minute, like they had less than 15 minutes to swing this game in the right way, and then they really needed that last goal. But shoulders weren't going up, like people weren't being stressed. You had Harry Kane settling people down and saying, listen, we got this, it'll be fine, we'll get the goal here. And that is such a different thing to what you've seen from England teams under pressure before.
And Southgate made some changes, they had an impact, Lingard had an impact at both ends. Jadon Sancho, who I know you've seen a lot of, Lars, also, and more than a lot of people, and he was brilliant against the USA as well, wasn't he?
He's really good, he's quite remarkable, and it's one of those things, you kind of have to try to stop yourself before getting too excited, because he's showing so much, but he's still very young, and you have to be careful, and you don't want to talk him up too much and all that, but he's enormously excited, and the impact he's had at Dortmund is remarkable. Dortmund currently one of the most fun teams in Europe to watch, and I think Southgate is using him quite cleverly. I mean, on some level it might have actually been tempted to start him for this, but you're using him as an impact sub, and that's probably right at this stage of his development.
At least he's getting a chance. Like, the old England way would be wait till he's sort of 31 and then sort of unleash him, you know.
But enormously exciting prospect. And I don't know. I just think it's interesting that this guy who couldn't, you know, get a chance at City, went abroad, and you wonder how many other Sanchos there could be at academies around England, because they do so well at under 19s and under 17s and under 21s. England national teams are doing really, really well, and there is a really, this is a hoary old point, but there is a big problem with the pathway to the first team, and you wonder if some more of these academy prodigies would go abroad to clubs where they're given game time, if there could be more Jadon Sanchos out there.
True. I mean, Phil Foden must be probably watching that game thinking, what if? I guess. I mean, he's just signing a new deal, right?
If I played every week for Gladbach or this sort of thing, like, where would Phil Foden be? And that's a rational question to ask him.
Chris says, do you think Dejan Lovren will stop proclaiming to be one of the world's best centre-backs now? I mean, I really enjoyed, Barry, how angry Lovren was getting by the end of that game. I mean, he was already told off before the game by his manager, having gone on Instagram, or I think it was Instagram, in the week before, proudly boasting that he'd elbowed Sergio Ramos, which is a sort of great shithouse meeting, isn't it? But I was just happy to see Lovren being that angry.
Sorry, I didn't really notice he was particularly angry.
Maybe I was really looking out for it. Did you notice that, Paul, or was it just me?
He always looks angry.
That's true.
The thing. It's one of his things.
I just kept, at the goals, he went to walk about a little bit, and it reminded me of the story that once went on like a pre-season training tour of Corsica, him with the Lyon squad, he got lost on a big bike ride. Like, they were doing a big bike ride and he got lost and they couldn't find him, and he had to bike really far to find his way back to his team, basically. And it's always suggested to me that his positioning might be a bit suspect. Like, his spatial awareness is not what it ought to be. And I think there was some of that on show yesterday.
Did he just keep saying how this proves he's the best bike rider in the country? Probably the best cyclist in the world.
Well, no, it's more a case of he's not allowed to go anywhere without his phone anymore, I think.
Anyway, that all means that England are through to the 14 Nations League finals to be hosted in Portugal. In 2019, Portugal, Poland and Italy all expressed an interest in hosting the finals. They were all in the same group, A3. It was decided whoever won that group would get to host it.
And now Poland and Italy are really relieved they didn't get it, because they won't have England fans visiting and descending upon them for a week.
Portugal, the goalless draw with Italy, they got them through. Switzerland, a ridiculous game. They had to beat Belgium by two clear goals. Is that right, Lars?
Yeah.
I think. And they were 2-0 down. Eden Hazard's brother scoring twice. And is that's how we should call him, obviously, isn't it?
Well, if you must.
Okay. Thorgan, if you want to. And then Switzerland scored 5 goals.
It's remarkable. The Belgians were, if I may, absolutely fondued in Switzerland. And it was just, it was very, very unexpected, because it's not something, I mean, you don't associate this. This is a Switzerland team with Haris Seferovic up front. Like, you don't associate them with that sort of barnstorming, goal-scoring feasts of football. But no, it was remarkable. And so much credit has to go to their coach, Pekovic, who's done a really good job there for a long time. It's not necessarily an easy team to manage, because, as we know, Switzerland is a divided country in terms of they have different, they're different parts of the country with different footballing traditions, and you also have a huge influx of first and second generation immigrants. So there's a lot of different cultures and personalities you have to manage in that squad, and it's a very tricky job. He's spoken about it in a very good interview with a Norwegian magazine that I sometimes work for, named Josimar, about how he actually feels that the expectations have been slightly too high, because the Swiss have been seeing this as the Shaqiri and the Xhakas as some sort of golden generation who should be taking the world by storm, whereas he feels actually they've been doing quite all right, thank you very much. And I think he's done a great job, and a remarkable result here. And it turns out, you know, Nasser Chadli, left wing back,
finally, not the right thing.
Yeah.
One of Netherlands and France will also be in. Holland played Germany tonight. That's Monday. They're 1 point behind France, but have a better head-to-head record. Paul, would you like it more, the Nations League, if this would replaced qualification for the Euros?
I think I probably would, to be honest. And I feel like, in a way, that's quite hypocritical, because I've always fighting the corner of the underdogs. And I do, in principle, I love that, you know, San Marino get to play against Germany, and, you know, you get that chance that everyone theoretically is equal. And that's a big part of what I love about sport. But in reality, I feel like qualification campaigns have got so stagnant with the current system that actually maybe the Nations League would be a better system, and that therefore, a team like San Marino, theoretically, very much theoretically, if they were to get promotion, then they would start to become able to qualify for the tournaments, rather than it being both running in parallel, which just seems to slightly just jar with me in some way.
I suppose the difficulty would be the first few years, people would have no chance of qualifying, which also doesn't seem fair either. You'd have to work out some kind of algorithm to give teams in Group D some sort of chance, however slim.
You may have to weight it slightly differently. I think a team like, again, San Marino, at the moment, a team like San Marino Andorra is unlikely to really raise many eyebrows if you said, look, you can't qualify. I think it would be probably clutching at straws to say that they believe they've got any chance of getting more than a couple of points out of each group campaign. But I agree, it would have to be structured slightly differently, because there's probably teams at the top of Group D there who would think there's a sniff of a chance of getting in. But even there, that, you know, it's a really big ask for them too. I don't know. Don't get me wrong. It's much better than friendlies, what we got going on. It just, as I say, it's slightly odd to have the two things in parallel, I think.
Here's a question from Paul. Can you ask Paul Watson if any of the pitches in Micronesia are worse than Wembley? Or better than Wembley?
Are they worse or better? Well, they're almost entirely flooded. So,
no.
No, they're probably worse. We would have settled for a game on Wembley. I had to paint all the lines by hand as well with someone's house paint, which again doesn't happen at Wembley really.
No. What shade did you use?
Well, it was pink. It was pink. That wasn't really my choice though. That was the only pot of paint we could find. And it rained anyway, so it washed off pretty fast.
Okay. Wales 1, Denmark 2. I thought Wales were a little unlucky in this game. Am I wrong?
They had chances, for sure. But it's been a hallmark of this Danish team under Åge Hareide is that they've gotten quite difficult to beat. Now, they relied on Kasper Schmeichel to come up with a couple of big saves, for sure. But and they were hit on the counter with the Jurgensen goal. Yeah, I can see your point in thinking. And I think it's interesting. I was fully expecting Denmark to win this on the basis of our good friend Ellis James talking about how the Welsh are actually not very good at all. Barry, was that not correct?
I wouldn't say he said they're not very good at all. I think he said they're nowhere near as good as he thought they were after they hammered Ireland. Mm. I think he underestimated just how bad Ireland were in that game. I think Wales beat us 4-1. And I do remember him, Danny Gabaldon, Nyan Roberts. I was chuckling away listening to them analyse that game, because I said, those boys are getting carried away here. They don't realise just how bad Ireland are. And I could understand their high spirits, because, you know, it was sort of the first competitive game of the Giggs era, and they are all obsessed with the Wales international team. But this game, I thought, Ryan Giggs picked a very attacking lineup, possibly too attacking, and that showed as both goals were scored against them on the counter-attack. He had Bale and Aaron Ramsey in, David Brooks, Tyler Roberts, and Tom Lawrence, you know, so... But they did have chances. They could probably consider themselves a bit hard done by to have lost. Highlight of the game for me was the ongoing war between Kasper Dahlberg and Ethan Ampadu. I don't know if you saw it, Max, but Dahlberg put Ampadu into the advertising hoardings with this brutal tackle. And about seconds later, Dahlberg was going up to head a ball that was dropping down him, and Ampadu, rather than be cowed by, you know, this intimidation, just clattered into the back of him. The yellow card comes out and he just took it and ran back into position. It was superb, really, really entertaining. And the crowd just rose and applauded Ampadu for getting his retaliation in. But yeah, it was another good game, another good Nations League game. And, you know, UEFA don't get a huge amount right, but I think they really got this right. My only grumble would be about, is there a way we can completely eliminate friendlies? Because they seem to be even more pointless now that we have this great alternative.
I mean, I was at Wembley for the USA game, and people did say, you know, the biggest cheer of the night was for Wayne Rooney coming on. I would contend that actually there was a slightly bigger cheer when one of the fans managed to get a paper aeroplane to land in the penalty area quite near Alex McCarthy. Because obviously, you knew Rooney was coming on. There was no jeopardy. He was going to run onto the pitch.
Do you think there was ever a second where Southgate just thought, what if I don't bring him on? Gets to 85 minutes and there's just like...
Makes him warm up again and then doesn't bring him on. The other thing I thought was if because Yedlin went past Rooney, didn't they, in one... Sort of, as soon as he came on and you were like, oh, he looks a bit off the pace. And a few ex-pros, we had two on the radio, Merce and Stuart Pearce both said Rooney was brilliant when he came on. I wasn't that sure about that particularly.
I didn't see this game.
But Rooney, Yedlin spins past Rooney and I thought, what if Rooney just went two-footed into the end, absolutely took him out hip high to see what the ref would be like. I don't really know what I meant to do. Anyway, there was no jeopardy with him coming on. There was jeopardy with this paper aeroplane.
Well, because if the ref sends him off, of course, he'll just pick the ball up and everyone he'll go home with it and that's the end of the game, isn't it?
Probably right. In the Wales-Denmark game, that volley from Martin Braithwaite was superb. And I'm, as you know, a huge fan of Scandinavians who basically sound like they should be playing for a League One team and don't have a Scandinavian name. So, you know, Josh King, Martin Braithwaite and...
Well, Braithwaite does play for a championship team.
Phil Billing the Llama.
Yeah.
Anyway, so good for you.
We can have a word about how, like, Åge Hareide, the manager of Denmark, is Norwegian. And listeners may or may not know that there's always been an element of snobbery in Denmark towards Norwegian football. I believe we've been informally referred to as mountain monkeys, which is understandable just given that they have a great heritage of, you know, the Laudrups and, you know, the great Euro-winning team and all this. Whereas
even dynamite.
Yeah, even while we were good, there was a sense that us being good mainly involved hoofing the ball in the general direction of a man named Flo. So I mean, I can see that from the Danish perspective, they've been slightly sort of one-uppity about that. And Åge Hareide, of course, he came in with the baggage of having won the league in Denmark. That helps. But just the idea that we have a Norwegian managing the Danish national team and doing really well is really cool. And I've seen the Danish press actually talk about him as possibly like one of the best coaches they've ever had. Extra blah noted the other, which is an extraordinary thing for them to write about a Norwegian person. And he's made them a little bit more solid and a bit more direct. Everything they used to kind of hate about us, but it's really working out for them. So. God bless Åge Hareide and the good work he's doing.
Did anyone see Ashley Williams getting into a bit of trouble? Obviously, he's an ex-Swansea player and all the Cardiff City fans do the Ayatollah celebration and he was being filmed just sort of walking through the stadium. There's a picture of all these Cardiff fans doing this and he said, look at all these mugs doing the Ayatollah. Cue social media frenzy. It was published on UEFA's Twitter page by mistake, or not by mistake, but then it was taken down. Some people very angry. Some people think not so angry.
Well, I'd be in the couldn't give a hoot camp very much so. You know, he's a Swansea legend, isn't he? And Swansea and Cardiff hate each other, but, you know, it doesn't take much to get people angry on Twitter, as you discovered last week, Max, when you had the temerity to... have someone from the Rainbow Laces campaign on the radio.
Look, it split the TalkSport message board, is how I'd say. Aaron Ramsey news, depending on who you read, Lars, Bayern Munich are closing in on his signature. Or Juve are planning to usurp the deal. You well, know
it's,
this
it's
sort
always
of stuff.
Been a bit of a strange quirk, that European clubs can sign... players from the Premier League to sort of pre-contracts after New Year's, whereas other Premier League clubs can't formally. I mean, sure, informally they can, of course, but I would absolutely love to see Aaron Ramsey go to a big club on the continent. I think far too few British players do, and I think as a player who clearly has more potential than he's ever fully been able to realise at Arsenal, I think that would be a wonderfully interesting move for him to make.
Do you think Emery's missing a trick by letting him go or not?
I don't know the ins and outs of that. I mean, I'm guessing that if his contract demands were within what Arsenal are happy to pay him, he would be signing a new contract. Now, I'm not judging him for wanting a big deal. He's at a point of his career like where this is his time to...
Last big move.
It's not his last big move, but certainly it's at a point where you'd want to certainly for a very large contract. And given the money they've... the contract they've handed out to Mesut Ozil, he's well within his rights to up his demands a little bit. And if that puts him out of Arsenal's range money-wise, you know, bearing in mind Arsenal have been out of the Champions League, they might have to look at their budget a little bit. I think it's a bit of a tricky situation. It's extraordinary that Arsenal yet again are in a position where they'll lose a big player either for free or for a drastically reduced fee. This is something they've done very badly over the years, not making sure their important assets are on long-term contracts. Presumably they will have learned from that and that it won't happen again quite so often.
It's the life of a footballer is, you know, it's just another illustration of how different it is, isn't it? I mean, I can't think of that many other worlds where you might have one last big money move, you know? I mean, it might stress you out, I suppose.
It might stress you out having sort of one last move or one last chance to shine in...
I don't know. I mean, because you live in this relative world, right? Financially, it's obviously ridiculous, but that's the world you're in. Yeah. And then to go, this is my last chance. You know, lots of people will be saying, this is your last chance to have a...
I should stress, sorry, he is 27, like he's not 30, but he's towards, like if he signs a four-year deal now, he'll be 31 at the end of that.
It's his penultimate chance, is what we're saying, really.
He should be at the peak of his powers.
He gets two more and then he's got to go MLS or he's got to go to, you know,
Qatar. That's a bit harsh, but there's an element of he is in the prime of his career. Mm. And if he, say, stay at Arsenal and is offered maybe half of what Mesut Ozil's on, it's understandable that he thinks that's kind of not on. So it might be. But again, I'm not privy to the ongoing contract negotiations, if there indeed are any. I'm just saying I think there's a financial element to it.
I wouldn't imagine he's particularly stressed because there'd be no shortage of takers for his services. But the worry, I suppose, nagging away at the back of your head if you're in his position, you know, what happens if he stays at Arsenal to the end of the season and then the second last game suffers some awful long-term injury, you know, then what? You're out of contract, you've no, possibly haven't signed anything else, and yeah, you know, he's probably not going to go hungry or anything, but it is something that would prey on your mind.
I wonder if he's also looking at Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain and the development that he had after leaving Arsenal for Liverpool. Put him in a different environment, different coaching, different system, and suddenly looked a much, much better player and was, to a much greater degree, fulfilling the potential that's already there.
Well, I mean, there is a different coaches at Arsenal now.
Yeah, that's a fair point, but he's been playing under them for a few months now and he hasn't signed a new contract. Yeah, so,
anyway, that'll do for part one. We'll carry on with some Nations League stuff in part two. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. We don't need to advertise the live show anymore. It's a sellout, isn't it? Max, Barry, Wilson and TBC. So well done. If you've got yourself a ticket, you will find out.
Are you, at this point, are you not revealing the TBC for fear that there might be returns?
Yeah, like
there
would if be we announce who it is and then tickets become available, we could kill the ego of TBC. So
before it was sold out, you wouldn't announce it just to create extra excitement.
People still might think it's really exciting. Yeah. Who's coming?
There's no TBC. We all know it.
It's just
you're clutching around, sending emails around, saying can anyone do this date? That's what you're doing.
That's normally how we fill the places on the pod. Look, Wales remain in league B after that defeat. Denmark promoted to League A and the Republic of Ireland have been relegated to League C. Brinksky asks, would Barry enjoy the Nations League a little more if Ireland tried participating in it?
Neither of the Ireland's, Republic of Ireland or Northern Ireland, have covered themselves in glory. The Republic of Ireland are currently caught in this circle of hell that is endlessly losing against Wales and Denmark. It's just every time I look, Ireland are being beaten by Wales and Denmark. It seems to have been going on for some years now, and I just want it to stop. And I suspect it will stop this week when Denmark beat us again, and then that's the end of it. And we can go with a whimper, slither down into group C, is it, or D? No, C.
It's a massive chance to lose to some new countries.
So, where we'll have the opportunity to lose against, Finland, because
they're going up. You're being passed by Finland and the great elevator of football. Oh,
Turkey, yeah, that'll be fun. Who's gone up here?
Well, Kosovo are coming up from League D, so I mean that's an exciting one.
Georgia, Belarus, Kosovo, Turkey.
Kosovo are not confirmed.
At least, if nothing else, it will be something new to look forward to, because I have just had it with being beaten by Wales and Denmark.
Would you, if you were the head of the FAI, would you get rid of O'Neill tonight or this afternoon?
Well, if I was the head of the FAI, that would mean I'd be John Delaney. And I think I'd have more pressing concerns than getting rid of Martin O'Neill.
Yes, but if John Delaney, if you took John Delaney's job.
Oh, well, that would be difficult. I think getting rid of John Delaney would be more tricky than the PFA getting rid of their boy, what's his name?
Gordon Taylor.
Gordon Taylor. It would be easy to say that Ireland should get rid of Martin O'Neill. I think he's clearly been there too long. But the question is whether or not they can afford to get rid of him. He's on quite a big, long contract. Interestingly enough, he's just become the Irish manager with the worst win percentage of all time, I think. And he gets paid more than twice as much money as Joe Schmidt, who just masterminded Ireland, the Irish rugby team's win over the All Blacks. And, you know, the Irish rugby team are arguably the best team in the world. O'Neill's on huge money. The FAI don't have any money and they can't afford to sack him. They also can't afford to hire a replacement. You know, they're not going to attract. I would almost put up the Big Sam insignia for Ireland. That's how bad they are. I don't think they could afford Big Sam.
How good are their players? I mean, if Pep took over Ireland, how much better would they be? I mean, they'd be better, that's fine.
They're an age. I'm struggling to remember a worse Irish team in my lifetime, to be honest. They're aging. Their training methods are being questioned. Martin O'Neill's methods and organisational skills are questioned. His relationship, you know, having a divisive character like Roy Keane as his number two is being questioned. He doesn't seem willing to provide any answers, and he's often just downright rude when genuinely pertinent questions are put his way. And I don't think anyone in Ireland is left in any doubt that he's, you know, he's given it his go. Someone else should come in. Mick McCarthy, for me, would be the ideal candidate. And I think Mick McCarthy has let it be known that he would be interested in the job. Again, whether they could afford him is open to question.
Would he keep Roy Keane as an assistant?
I would say no.
Northern Ireland, as you mentioned, also have had a pretty poor Nations League. They had a goalless draw with the Republic, which sounded like a cracker late last week.
Well, to be fair to Northern Ireland, they hammered the Republic in that goalless draw. Darren Randolph pulled off some sensational saves, otherwise Northern Ireland would have won comfortably. But they have genuine problems scoring goals there. I think they've converted one of their last 48 chances.
Yeah, they scored against Austria, but they lost last minute defeat, actually. Apparently a positive...
Oh, sorry, make that two in 49 then.
Apparently a positive performance for Michael O'Neill's side, but still they lost. And you wonder, Lars, if Michael O'Neill should have gone, when he was at his peak there. And that's not a slight on what he achieved, because what he achieved in the Euros was just unbelievable.
But yeah, I get that that's how football works sometimes. I'd just be very depressed if people overlook that and think, oh, well, Northern Ireland are bad now, so he must be bad. Like, I mean, I get that that's how a lot of club chairmen think, but I'd hope they wouldn't be quite so thick. Because, I mean, he's working with a very, very small talent pool there, and the fact that they have reached the heights that they have is extraordinary. The fact that they have fallen away is maybe not something he should be blamed for, in my opinion. But maybe that's the way it goes. I mean, that would be hugely depressing if true.
Paul, did you see Gareth McCauley? Let me show you Gareth McCauley and Marko Arnautovic. McCauley taking on Arnautovic in a sort of definitely in a wrestling move. Could you talk me through that?
There's some UFC in there. There's also something quite tender about it.
A mixture of hate and love.
Yeah, I think it is. Well, he's a love-hate player, Arnautovic, isn't he? He's one of those guys that, you know, you love to hate him, and then you sort of hate to love him. And
you just go around and so it's like the Denmark... the Denmark Wales,
the Denmark
Irish vortex.
But he had a real go at James Tarkowski recently for West Ham as well. I mean, I like this new sort of warlike Arnautovic, just, you know, really very openly hostile towards his markers.
The interviewer said, "What happened with you and Macaulay?" Arnold Rich said, "I'm not sure. He tried to choke me or fight me, but it's not a good idea to fight me."
That's probably true.
So choking doesn't count as fighting?
No, they're separate.
Oh, yeah, right,
they're separate games.
Right, of course.
Do you think Arnautovic had and Macaulay had a prearranged safe word? Maybe Arnautovic just couldn't remember what it was. He's sitting there going, tennis racket.
Why is he saying that? good win for Scotland. And some lovely goals as well. 4-0 they won in Albania. Considering it, you know, half the country ruled themselves out before the game. Ryan Fraser scored a lovely goal. James Forrest scored two. His second and Scotland's fourth was a glorious goal where his first touch flicked it over the defender with his right foot and he volleyed it in with his left.
It was a hugely impressive display from Scotland. Like, really, really good. And as you said, I think they ten players.
Nine, I think it was.
Who were stood down through injury. And, you know, a lot of them big-name players who would have been first choice. But, again, Alex McLeish and going against sort of the stereotype that's attributed to him, unfairly in my opinion, picked a really attacking side and look what happened. They took the game to an Albania side who admittedly weren't very good, but
went down to 10 men as well.
Had a nice sending off
after 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Probably their best defender getting sent off after 20 minutes helps. And Scotland, it became sort of an ideal type of game for them since they have Ryan Fraser and they also have James Forrest. They had real speed on the counter there, facing a 10-man Albania who had to try to go forward and get a result. But no, huge win for them, absolutely. And it's just looking at their lineup, they're not very bad. I mean, there are some really interesting players there. They shouldn't be in the state that they have been. I'm sure Scottish people will be, you know, echoing my complaints there. I mean, the fact that they went into this, there was a real chance of them going down to Group D. Like, I mean, that's looking at the names in their squad there, that's not where they ought to be.
No, they'll win their group if
they beat Israel. Yeah, Israel need Israel. A point. And Scotland need to win. Rocco says, do you think Ryan Fraser will still be at Bournemouth this time next year? Which clubs could you potentially see him moving to? I know you're a fan, Barry.
It's hard to know, really. I
suppose the question is he good enough to be in one of those top four sides, or is he the... Because Bournemouth are racing for seventh, so like, where do you go? A bigger club who aren't as good as Bournemouth? Or do you go to one of those top six sides?
I don't know. I don't see enough of him to know exactly how good he is, but he has come on in leaps and bounds this season.
Kind of reminds me of what people always ask about Eddie Howe. You know, where can he end up? Mm. And actually, when you start looking at it, he's pretty much where you want to be in terms of you're not really going to land one of the top three or four.
Couldn't he?
Maybe.
I think Eddie Howe for Tottenham, if and when Pochettino moves on, is maybe not. I'd check out what the bookies make of that.
It could be a while, though, couldn't it?
Well, we were talking to Carl Fletcher.
Well, you wonder if, hypothetically, next summer, if both the Real Madrid... Well, Real Madrid, they have Solari now, but, you know, drummers in Spinal Tap and all that, the Real Madrid managers, they seem to come and go. But, you know, if we're in a situation where Real Madrid and Man United are both available and Pochettino is like a little bit fed up with life at Spurs.
I don't know.
I've derailed this conversation completely. Well, the thing I was going to say is that I've been hugely guilty of this myself, so there's a level of hypocrisy here, but we always do this when a player who's not playing for one of the top teams looks good for a prolonged period of time. He's like, oh, where should he go? Can we not just have a league where there are actually good players kind of like distributed amongst
all the teams? It's not how it works, Lars.
I know, but I wish it would be, and they have enough financial resources because of the Premier League TV money, and that is pretty evenly distributed, actually. They have enough finances to put these guys on some pretty hefty contracts, as with Zaha, for instance, and Crystal Palace. So maybe they could just stick around. Like,
it sounds a bit like communism, what you're saying here.
Not at all.
Quite well-paid communism. Barry, you were going to mention Cole Fletcher.
Oh, yeah, just we spoke to him last week, and he told us...
And he's the loans manager now at Bournemouth, was the...
Yeah, former Bournemouth midfielder, and now on the staff, on the coaching staff, and in charge of loaning out youngsters and whatnot. But yeah, he mentioned a few of the jobs or that Eddie Howe could have taken but hasn't. And yeah, they were pretty big jobs, but not
big, big jobs, if you know what I mean.
So, state of play in the Nations League. We mentioned it earlier. Holland have got the chance to get into the semi-finals after their 2-0 win over France. Young team, two 21-year-olds, one 19-year-old, controlled the game. Goals from Wijnaldum and Memphis Depay at the end of each half. So that's England, Portugal, Switzerland, and one of France and Holland in the finals. Relegated from League A, Croatia, Germany, Iceland, and Poland. Replacing them and promoted from League B will be Denmark, Ukraine, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and Russia or Sweden, who meet in a shootout in Stockholm on Tuesday night. I mean, that's a football match, just to point out. Turkey, Northern Ireland, Republic are relegated to League C. Slovakia, the Czech Republic have a survival match tonight. Below that, mostly up for grabs. Lithuania, Slovenia, Estonia and Albania will be slumming it in League D next time around. Only Finland, out of the League C hopefuls, have earned their place in League B so far. Some crunch games coming up tonight and tomorrow.
Finland earning it by losing, by the way, to Hungary, only for the Estonians to grab a shock win away to Greece. So, I mean, that's the way to go for the Finns. Just let the others, let the Estonians sort it out for you. Norwich hero Teemu Pukki, having played a big, big part for Finland. Not really turning up this time, but, yeah, in general.
Thank you, Lars, for that Scandinavian insights. What you're here for, isn't it?
We got it. Also, Norwich. I mean, Teemu Pukki is huge down there now.
Georgia and Belarus have been promoted from League D. Two more spots up for grabs. Kosovo and Macedonia in the driving seats in their groups at the moment. Kieran says, now we found out that San Marino, with no wins and no goals scored, are the worst of the worst. Is it time to scrap the Nations League? What we do need is a group, a new group of like Group E, with the bottom sides from Group D, can all play against each other. So Andorra, who got 3 points from three draws, Malta, 2 points, Liechtenstein got one win, 3 points, and San Marino with no points. Is anybody with me for a Group E of just those four?
Yeah, I mean, when you say with you, do you mean would travel to all those games? Then yeah, of course.
No, I know
the idea, like the loser gets blasted into space or something.
never plays again. One of the fun was seeing these teams play against each other and know who was actually okay at football and who isn't. And now we found out that these are the worst four in Europe.
I do feel like San Marino has staked a very strong claim there with their no wins, no draws, six defeats with no goals scored in their group in Group D.
That's true. I mean, the phone-ins on, you know, San Marino Sports.
San Marino 606, yeah, fury.
They were. Paul Watson, you tweeted this. I imagine all anyone wants to talk about on the pod is Yorkshire 5, Punjab 4.
Yeah, it turns out that wasn't the case. But no. Yeah, that was all my prep as well. So.
But that's, I mean, it's not an encounter I was expecting.
It's not an encounter many people expected, but
sounds like a cracker.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing with our to do a little plug for CONIFA, which is the alternative FIFA that I'm kind of in part of running. What we're doing is just giving sort of other identities a chance to have their own international structure. So it's sort of like grassroots international football, really. So you've got a Yorkshire team there playing against Punjab team. Jersey have just joined us, but under a different name. They're called the Parishes of Jersey because the Jersey FA are obviously going down a different route. They want to get into UEFA still.
So is that so the Jersey
FA? Are you saying Yorkshire have now declared themselves an independent football nation?
No, it's more complex than that. I mean, right, in a way, yes, in that our structure allows people to have their own identity that plays against other international identities. But in terms of like it being to do with independence, it's more complex. It's more just saying that we have an identity that we want to play under the banner of, which actually, when you think about it, you can be from Yorkshire and be more passionate about Yorkshire than about England. I mean, you see that quite regularly.
Because I think, brace yourself in this case for an application from Cork.
We've heard that. Yeah,
really?
You're not the first to...
Because they're kind of like Yorkshire, the Irish equivalent of Yorkshire folk, in that they talk funny and think they're better than everyone else, even though they're clearly not.
it's like we're getting quite a few. I mean, we've got Sardinia have just come in last week. Cornwall have come in.
Right.
And I think it's just like, it's basically just saying to people, why shouldn't you be able to play under those banners? I mean, obviously you have the FIFA structure. We're not trying to knock that down. But, you know, what's so damaging about a team of people from Cornwall saying we want to represent Cornwall?
And surely put them all in a big league and the winner plays San Marino.
Well, yeah, they're very welcome to
it. Do the Jersey, the Parishes of Jersey, are they trying to do this on the sly without Jersey noticing?
So,
if a Jersey FA man walks along, they're just like, look over there and, you know, create a diversion.
Is that the Yorkshire team? Yeah. No, what? No. It's all kind of understood. The Channel Islands is a slightly weird situation. I imagine you're pretty well versed on Channel Islands football dynamics. But
well, I've seen Bergerac.
Exactly. Well, that's it. I mean, basically, the situation.
And you know Matt Letizia.
I know Matt Letizia and Graham Lassow, actually. So, yeah.
So you know most of the channel. I mean, the situation there is this complex thing that a lot of places find themselves in, that they can't quite get access to UEFA. It's all a very grey area. Guernsey have obviously come into the English League, so they're competing in there as a club team. They also have the Moratti, which is like the Channel Islands Cup for Oldney, Jersey and Guernsey. And it just sort of leaves a gap where, you know, these islands are thinking, well, why don't we actually get to play international competition? You also have the Island Games, which is in Anglesey next year, as the Inter Games. So you're going to have all these little islands there. The truth is you just need a lot of different structures for people to play football. And FIFA tries to kind of just shoehorn everyone into one. But we're just saying, well, what's the harm in letting people come out and play as Yorkshire, come out and play as, you know, their region?
Where's Sark fit into all of this?
Sark are not the powerhouse you might think. They do have a team. They play Guernsey every now and again, I think. But they've taken a couple of beatings, I think.
And the level is the level random? I know we've talked about in this, the Kenefa World Cup. Yeah. You know, Yorkshire and Punjab look reasonably well matched.
Oh, it's a good level. I mean, you're looking, these are players that are at sort of, you know, Conference South and around that level, you know, maybe Conference North, Conference South, and the division's just below there. So it, as I say, in a way, it is a sort of grassroots international football in that it's not park football. These are not kind of bad quality players. They're just, you know, they're not also the highly paid professional players. It's something a bit more real, you know, in a lot of ways. It's like international football, but with some humanity to it. Basically.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm all in favour.
Oh, well, that's all right then. Oh, well, I thought we had a problem there, yeah, but no.
Carry on.
We're fine.
Do carry on, Paul.
Oh, I won't cancel it then.
On to domestic matters. League One, very little movement in the top eight. Six of them won, two of them drew. That's Lars Sivertsen's death, timed at 11:39 on Monday, November the 19th. Second place Sunderland needed an 84th minute equaliser to share the points with visitors Wickham. How do you feel about just, I mean, Sunderland are doing well, but it's funny to say that given how good Sunderland once were, to be like, you just scraped a draw with Wickham, or are you sort of at happy with that?
No, I'm happy with that. I think quite a few Sunderland fans weren't happy with that. There was a bit of grumbling about not beating Wickham at home, you know, if you're going to be serious promotion contenders, but I think Wickham have got good results against Peterborough and Portsmouth as well, if I'm not mistaken. I need to check. But no, I'm happy enough.
Luton are fifth. They won 5-1 against Plymouth. Jamie Collins scoring a hat-trick. Pick of the goals was scored by left-back James Justin after a 16-pass move. They were all in orange. Look, it was like Cruyff playing for the Hatters. In League Two, MK Dons lead the way after a 2-0 win over bottom side Macclesfield, who are 7 points adrift already. They've only got 7 points this season, Macclesfield. Second place Lincoln didn't play. Newport leapfrog Colchester, move into third after they beat them 2-0. Cambridge United took the lead at Oldham with a glorious George Maris strike. Then they let in three in the second half. Very unlucky to do so, including a comedy wander about by their 76-year-old goalkeeper David Ford. They are 18th in League Two. And let's all salute Jamie Cureton. Here is his tweet. What a great performance result today by the boys. He's playing for Bishop Stortford in the Bostic League. They beat Whitehawk 4-2. He scored three. In doing so, I've hit, not me, him, the 350 mark. 350 goals in his career. A massive personal milestone. Jamie Cureton says, I'd like to thank everyone who has helped me along the way to achieve this, which is presumably everyone in football, given how many teams he's played for. This is from Jim. After the lad playing for Ayr got sent off for a fantastic boot to an opponent's swingers, what's your favourite ever sending off? This is Craig Moore. He kicked Gregor Buchanan right in the wotsits. He was fouled, and I feel slightly sorry for him, Craig, because he was tackled from behind, and there was Buchanan sort of kicked the ball. The ball was underneath Craig Moore, and Buchanan kicked the ball quite hard and kicked his leg. So Moore sort of...
It was like a donkey kick, wasn't it? He was on
kick.
All
yeah.
fours
yeah.
and just
But doesn't the ref then go back and book the other guy? The guy who's just been kicked in the balls, then gets a yellow card seconds later.
Yeah, he definitely deserved that yellow.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he could have got sent off, but I don't know if anyone has an absolute favourite ever sending off. Obviously, Cantona's had a couple. The Cameroon in Italia 90.
That would... What was Massing?
I think so, yes.
That
clearing out Caniggia.
Yeah.
Now, the Zaire player, was it, who booted the ball at the free kick? Now, was he sent off?
No, that was just a yellow.
Just a yellow for that. That would have been my favourite.
No, that was marvellous.
Red card.
We were talking a bit about Arnautovic earlier. He had an amazing one in Germany where he got, admittedly, quite a soft booking for backing into a defender under a high ball. And he was very cross with this when he received his yellow card. And he did this thing where he moved to whack the ball at the referee. Like, he looked like he was going to whack the ball at the referee and then didn't. And the referee just sort of did a double take and looked at him like, hang on, did you just... Yeah, I have to book you again now. And then he got sent off. It was very, very funny.
So he got booked for pretending to boot
the
ball.
Well, the sort of threatening to... He might as well have booted it. He might as well. I mean, it would have had pretty much the same outcome and it would have been even funnier. But I just think... On the scale of daft red cards, that was amazing.
Paul Rayner, Cambridge player, got sent off for headbutting our own centre-back, Mick Heathcote, in a 6-0 defeat at Brentford. Players getting sent off for fouling their own teammates is high up there, isn't it? Anyway, that'll do for part two. We'll talk Richard Scudamore and Gordon Taylor after the break. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So we were wondering on Thursday's pod if Richard Scudamore was going to bow down to popular opinion and turn down a £5 million present, which was going to be made up of £250,000 from each Premier League club. And then shortly after we finished recording at that scandalously early hour, Barry, I don't know whose fault that was, Richard Scudamore said he was going to take the money.
Yeah, it was a huge surprise.
Since then, specific concerns that he was going to take a job at La Liga or the Football League or something was a decisive
Well, as far as
this.
I can tell, he got this golden goodbye from all the Premier League clubs, and now it turns out he's not actually going anywhere because he's still going to be working as some sort of consultant for the Premier League, despite having been replaced as their chief executive. And yeah, there is talk he was possibly going to take a job with La Liga and now won't. And I'm kind of wondering, does this signal some sort of lack of faith on the part of Bruce Buck and some of the clubs who instigated... Well, it's Bruce Buck from Chelsea who instigated this gift on behalf of his shooting buddy and his pal. And, yeah, does this signify some sort of lack of faith in the incoming chief executive?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think... It's like those things where people say, I think this happens in big business a lot. Now, obviously, I don't know what happens in big business at all.
Or small business.
I don't know what happens anywhere in anything. However, you can understand why they wouldn't want him, if he was a free agent, to go and play for someone else, I guess.
Yeah, it's an giving people a load of money so they won't go off and work for competitors is an interesting strategy and one that might work.
Hmm. Apparently, there's... He'll now receive the money directly from the Premier League's central fund over 3 years rather than a direct series of £250,000 payments from clubs.
God, it'd be really nice, wouldn't it, if you just sit and watching your bank, online banking, just watching these little ding, 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 all these little 250 grand payments.
It's like when I get all my teammates to give me 12 quid each for subs. Yeah. And I check my bank, and you've got six in there, yes.
That's why he's not going to La Liga, isn't it? It's just refresh.
So, look, he's got lots of money, which is nice for him. Gordon Taylor also has loads of money. An open letter calling on the chief executive of the PFA to step down has been endorsed at the time of podding by 300 footballers, current and former players. It was 200 overnight. It's understood the letter will call for the election of a new chief executive. Gordon Taylor's been here for 37 years. A new chairman of the PFA, Ben Perkis, said we just need to review what actually happens at the PFA. And as far as we can tell, the PFA have a lot of money in the bank, Barry, and spent millions on a...
Well, they're sitting on a fund of between 40 and 50 million pounds. And the amount they've paid out to footballers in need, whether, footballers suffering from physical injury, retired footballers who may not have been as well paid as the current crop,
footballers suffering from mental issues, addictions, dementia. You know, they're all well documented. The amount they pay out is just like tiny compared to the amount they're sitting on. And yeah, this guy, what's his name? Ben Perkis just wants an overhaul on how things are done, and now it looks like the PFA, Gordon Taylor and his cronies, may try to move to have him ousted, because they're saying technically he shouldn't be in the PFA because he's a non-contract player.
Mm. Perry Groves was making the point that here's somebody who's a non-contract player, i.e. doesn't really have a job, is sort of loosely freelance. Exactly the sort of person the PFA should be helping. And what they're trying to do is get him sacked from one of the bits of work that he's actually doing. I mean, it seems completely ludicrous.
Well, it's guys looking after themselves, you know. It's a classic thing in sports administration. And Gordon Taylor doesn't have a monopoly on self-preservation, and it will be interesting. It could end up going to court. So,
Danny Taylor wrote a savage piece, a brilliant piece yesterday, which is definitely worth reading. I mean, the painting got me. If you're buying a painting for $2 million and you're investing £100,000 into dementia, there's a problem there. And as Dave Kitson said on the radio to us yesterday, the PFA don't go looking for the problems, right? They're not proactive in trying to help their members, which is clearly a really important thing you could do. I mean, you could build a whole rehab centre for £50 million, couldn't you? That'd be a good idea for footballers. Not just, you know, not for all sorts of things, injury as well, like whatever. I mean, there are things they could do with that money. We will see what happens. This is a question from Darshan on the subject of VAR being introduced next season. Is Charlie Austin the most powerful footballer in the Premier League, Lars?
Clearly.
Are we happy with VAR? I mean, I'd have brought it in next week if you could. They've been trialling it in non-live situations, or they've been having non-live trials.
I've said this on the pod before, I feel slightly iffy about having it for the first half of the season and not for the other half of the season. I think teams who, for instance, have already played away games to big teams and maybe not gotten the refereeing decisions will be slightly cross to see their competitors get a fair shot at that in the second half, for instance. I guess having it in the latter stages of the Champions League, you don't have that sort of integrity problem. I understand why the Premier League took the decision they did in not bringing it in, because there was a lot of uncertainty about how well it would work. But when we saw in the World Cup that it worked a lot better than anyone, and frankly myself included, had expected, it's only rational to bring it in now.
David McNamara, that referee who had accepted his punishment for playing rock, paper, scissors, or paper, scissors, stones in place of a coin toss, is going to appeal his 3-week ban. He went on record to say he appreciated the tremendous messages of support from his refereeing colleagues around the world. I heard some refs were all going to do paper, scissors, stone during their games, but I don't know if they actually did that.
I mean, there was a Norwegian ref named Peri Vastarberg who did it quite a lot because he tended to forget his coin. And I guess it was the Norwegian league, so no one really cares. But I completely slipped my mind last week when we were talking about this. I get that. People, given the fact that the women's game struggles to be taken as seriously as it ought to be, I understand why people felt this was silly. I do tend to think that if it had happened in a Premier League game and you had, like, I don't know, Anthony Taylor going, like, I've got a coin, lads, just do rock, paper, scissors, I don't think we would have made a huge deal of it. I really don't. I think we would have thought it was a bit funny and moved on. But
It's another way that we're losing our sense of humour. We're losing a sense of proportion for these things, you know. These are human beings doing a job. And, you know, this is a sport. At the end of the day, it nothing can be done by humans anymore.
Are you about to say nothing matters again, Paul?
No, I've got over that. I actually got over this existential funk in the break there. But
I would say, though, that since we're a panel of men sort of writing this off as not important, if you spend a lot of your life on women's football and you're very passionate about it and you feel like this sat wrong with you, I'm not going to sit here and say that you're wrong to feel that. I mean, that would be preposterous.
Oh, yeah. But for me, it's not to do whether it was a women's game or men's game. It could be in the World Cup final. Ultimately, he didn't have a coin, he sorted it out.
But I guess that was the feeling, was that if he'd been reffing a men's game in the Premier League, he would have had his coin, I guess, is the suggestion.
But I don't think he left it on purpose. I don't get the impression that someone working in women's football cares any less about what they're doing. I don't think it's got anything to do with that in my eyes. It's just this constant need for our officials to be faultless and everyone has to do everything perfect. It's why VAR is coming in, even though it's completely unnecessary. If we just accept that humans make mistakes, then we can actually go back to what we did for, you know, decades and decades of enjoying this sport and just accept that sometimes things aren't done perfectly.
On last week's pod, we were discussing whether any footballers actually go to the supermarket themselves. And Mark Langdon, Podder, said, last Thursday's show, I can confirm that West Ham keeper Adrian does push his own supermarket trolley, a true man of the people. Alan said, I saw Jovinho come out of the Barnet High Street, Iceland once, certainly carrying his own bags. So I'm guessing he also pushed a trolley as well, unless he just did two baskets. You look confused, Barry.
I don't think we were questioning whether footballers go to the supermarket themselves. I mean, why wouldn't they? The suggestion was that if you were a footballer and had loads of money, you would go to a supermarket further away from your house. If it was, say, a posher supermarket to, you know, a Waitrose 10 miles away instead of a Morrison's 2 miles away.
Oh, I was definitely wondering if they are.
Why wouldn't they?
I don't know how many would. I think they'd get it delivered, or they'd just have a person to do it. I reckon.
Yeah, I'd say that. I'd say you get it delivered, like all celebrities probably don't necessarily want
to. Where do you draw the line then?
What list of celebrities?
Are you saying that if money was no object, you wouldn't do any household tasks whatsoever?
Well, no, definitely. I would. But I reckon if you get to a certain level of fame, going to your local Morrison's would be a more hassle than it's worth. If you're Al Pacino, right, your weekly shop at Lidl would take you forever.
What, because you'd be scourged by people looking for selfies?
I very rarely get a photo, right, with any famous person, except for maybe Carl Kennedy from Neighbours, right? However, if I was, my nearest supermarket is a Waitrose, conveniently, really good, but if I was, you know, buying the future former Mrs. Rushton's extra virgin oil hummus, and I saw Beckham there, I might be tempted to ask for a photo.
Would you?
Maybe not Beckham. I would be like, oh, that's a bit weird. David Beckham's there. I don't think many...
But David Beckham would probably know who you were and wouldn't mind stopping for a bit of chit-chat.
I don't know if he would. But that's not the point. I don't reckon...
The point is, don't ask people for photos if they're just going about their day. Like, leave them alone.
But it wouldn't happen. If Sergio Aguero was in Sainsbury's, look at producer John, his head is bowed, was in Sainsbury's, you know, choosing which biscuits to get, I think it would be hassle for him.
I think there was a club recently, and I think it was a relatively low club, where the manager actually said in public, if you see any of my players out in public, talk to them, and if they're not courteous, let me know.
I
remember actually at the time thinking, I'm not sure I agree with this. I mean, these guys are just normal people. It was a League Two club maybe or somewhere around there. I was just thinking, is that a fair demand to be made on anyone, really? I mean, obviously not to be rude to people, but to be expected to be on when you're a footballer.
Brian says, if the panel had to take the reins at a club, which club would best suit them? Barry at Ipswich would be fun.
I wouldn't be able to run a club or manage a team. I'd be useless.
I'd also be useless, Lars.
So, yeah, I'll go to Ipswich, take him down.
Completely terrible. I think it's fair to say Paul's the only one on the panel who I think...
You've got some experience.
Yeah, I mean, if, say, like, the St Helena job comes up or something like that, you know, you always wonder, don't you? You always wonder if that knock's going to come on the door and it's the Aruba job. But, no, in terms of the English league, you've got to look at a job like Barnet, because if you get it once, you get it six times. So
yeah,
you get that stability of it coming back to you.
Good public transport links.
Yeah, lovely. Lovely.
Andre Villas-Boas had a short stint.
US
at
Virgin
Barnet?
Islands,
yeah.
Oh, not at Barnet, no. Was it the British Virgin Islands or
it
US
was one
Virgin
of them.
Islands? One of them.
Did he get
the British Virgin Island team, yeah.
Now, is that a tax-free? I mean, did he get another massive payoff? Is that?
I don't know.
I think it was at the start of his career, yeah, so I don't think there were any massive payoffs going on. He was like 21 or something.
Yeah, but he might have just been the technical director.
Finally, Liam asks, is Barry Z-list enough to go on I'm a Celebrity in the near future? I'm not saying you have to be washed up to go on such a programme, but I'd rather watch a respected journalist eat a kangaroo's penis than somebody from The Only Way Is Chelsea.
I have never been asked to go on anything. I suspect I'm nowhere near famous enough. Have you been asked?
No.
Right. Well, if you haven't, I have no chance.
Somebody did message in, could one of us watch it and update us on what Harry Redknapp's doing, because they couldn't be bothered to watch it. But I didn't watch it yesterday, so I can't give you any Harry Redknapp updates.
Well, Harry's first task involved having to lean out a car window
and,
you know, grab things out of a box full of creepy crawlies. And he mentioned that he used to think he was good at driving until the unfortunate day where he accidentally ran over his own wife and seriously damaged her ankle ligaments and thought briefly that he'd killed her. So I think Harry would be very entertaining on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, and I'm looking forward to seeing how he gets on.
Will you update us every pod?
I can do, yeah.
Producer Jonathan shakes his head. No.
Well, it's considerably more interesting than much of the stuff we discuss, so I'm happy to do so.
Right, well, that'll do for today. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Lars.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Barry.
You're very welcome.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.